today, Chief Justice Contreras, Justice Silva, and Justice Peña. With my time here today, I want to focus on two key things. First, the evidence that plaintiff contends supports his $60,000 award for future physical impairment is factually insufficient because it does not have a distinct injury having a substantial effect. And two, a new trial is the appropriate remedy in this case because after considering all of the evidence on the record, it is contrary to the overwhelming weight of all the evidence and is manifestly unjust. For a physical impairment award, you need a showing of something more than pain. Pain alone is insufficient to substantiate physical impairment and results in double recovery. Evidence of physical impairment requires a showing of a distinct injury having a substantial effect, which results in the loss of enjoyment of one's life because of a physical cause. In other words, the pain stops or severely inhibits one's ability to do something that they were previously able to do before the accident.
Ms. Kidder, let me stop you right there. Mm-hmm. So there was no definition of physical impairment in the jury charge. Was the jury given this explanation in argument or during trial that it could consider all of these aspects, as you just mentioned, such as loss of enjoyment of life?
There was no definition, that's correct. The jury was instructed not to award the plaintiff twice for the same injuries. So in this case, there was evidence of pain and mental anguish, and the plaintiff was compensated for that. The plaintiff was not, however, compensated for past physical impairment, and plaintiffs argue that the same evidence that the jury heard with respect to that past physical impairment, which would have been his the fishing, car maintenance, housework, the inability to sleep, the jury rejected all that in considering past physical impairment. So the same weak evidence cannot also substantiate an award for future physical impairment.
But could the jury, from the evidence that was submitted by Mr. Ortiz plus his friend and the doctor, could the jury not have inferred from that evidence a loss of enjoyment of life?
The jury, when you look at the totality of the evidence here, there just simply was none that rose to the level of a distinct injury having a substantial effect. The jury, there was ample evidence of plaintiff's past issues sleeping that later resolved before trial, and the jury rejected all of that evidence. So to say that that same evidence is sufficient to support a future physical impairment shows that this case involves double recovery. When you look at...
Counsel, can you direct us to case law that requires recovery of past damages as a prerequisite of future damages, as argued by the other side?
I don't have any case law with me at this time, but I'd be happy to provide a letter brief after oral argument if that's what the court would like. Here there is testimony that plaintiff doesn't no longer do certain activities, but when you look at the record as a whole, there's no actual link between his inability to do those things and the pain. When he talks about fishing, he says that he hasn't gone fishing since the accident because he's scared. He's afraid that somebody was going to crash into him. Housework and maintenance, he does testify that he doesn't do those things anymore, but he never explains why. And in fact, his friend did testify that he still does those things when she motivates him, and that she suspects that the reason he doesn't do those things anymore is because he thinks a lot about the accident. All of that stems from a mental cause, not a physical cause, which is required for physical impairment.
So what? Give me an example of what a distinct injury would be in this case that he would have had to have shown.
So the case law, the examples in the case law show the inability to play with your children anymore because of the pain, the inability to drive anymore because you can no longer turn your neck with a full range of motion, the inability to play sports, or the fact that the pain is so severe that you have to give up doing the things that you previously enjoyed doing before the accident. And here, we don't see any evidence linking his pain to these things that he no longer does post-accident. Another example is he doesn't testify that he no longer works on his car, but his friend mentioned that when asked whether or not plaintiff works on his car, she said, quote, "not that I know of." But she never explains why he doesn't work on his car. And if you look at the record, you'll see that plaintiff didn't have his car after the accident. So it's unclear if the reason he doesn't work on his car anymore is because of pain or simply because he didn't have the opportunity to work on his car because he didn't have it in his possession at the time. The common factor here in all these activities is that he never says pain prevents him from doing these things. These are just things he doesn't do post-accident. And his testimony shows that his inability to do these things is mental. He's afraid. He's angry. This isn't physical pain, and this isn't physical pain, and it's not enough for physical impairment. With respect to plaintiff's trouble sleeping, the record established that his sleeping issues had resolved prior to trial. That could have supported an award for past physical impairment, but the jury awarded zero for past physical impairment. The plaintiff relies on his friend's testimony where she said that he would call her and tell her that he couldn't sleep because of the pain. But the court has to look at the totality of the evidence and break it down, because when you look at it all, there's no evidence that his trouble sleeping would continue into the future. The testifying doctor, Dr. Almonte, he testified that the sleeping issues had resolved. Plaintiff himself did not testify that he has a continued inability to sleep. And the medical records also showed that following his treatment, his pain levels were at zero and his discomfort while sleeping had resolved. To say that this one statement that a plaintiff's friend testified that he couldn't sleep substantiates a $60,000 award for future physical impairment is not what the standard requires. Without a distinct injury having a substantial effect, then in any case you can have someone with secondhand knowledge come in and say, plaintiff can't sleep, and that would substantiate an award for $60,000, $120,000, $500,000 in future physical impairment. And that's not what the standard is, and that's not what it should be. Affirming a $60,000 award on this scant testimony would be contrary to the overwhelming weight of all of the evidence. With respect to Dr. Almonte's testimony, he does not identify a specific task or activity that plaintiff can no longer perform. He makes generalizations about plaintiff's symptoms and how people with this sort of injury can sometimes be limited in their activities, but he doesn't point to a specific activity and link plaintiff's pain to this, to his inability to do a particular activity. Dr. Almonte's testimony is insufficient to support a physical impairment award because it fails to show that plaintiff's pain hindered his ability in whole or in part to do something.
Didn't he testify that his complaints of pain with increased activity, lifting, difficulty sleeping, which you've addressed, and that it's permanent and serious. Each time he receives treatment, it will cause new pain. I mean, it does seem that he did go into some specifics about limitations that Mr. Ortiz has now. Why was that not sufficient?
Yes, he did testify to those things, but in reviewing the record as a whole, that is not sufficient because what Dr. Almonte is talking about there are his symptoms and his pain. He talks about that the injury is permanent, but evidence of an injury alone is not sufficient for physical impairment. And simply saying that because he's going to have pain in the future without actually linking it to an activity that he's no longer going to be able to do or that is severely disabling or that is a severely disabling loss is not what the standard is for physical impairment. There needs to be a severe injury causing a substantial effect. And the examples provided by Dr. Almonte would support an award of pain, which plaintiff was awarded $45,000 for his future pain and suffering and
so
mental anguish.
So you're arguing that the testimony that the doctor provided is sufficient for that award for pain and suffering, but not for the impairment, future impairment.
Correct. Yes. And again, just reviewing the record as a whole, if the court does hone in on those portions of the record and the testimony, it still does not substantiate $60,000. The evidence that plaintiff points to is so weak and contrary to the overwhelming weight of the evidence that it does require a new trial. Intermediate appellate courts have shown extreme caution when reviewing physical impairment awards because of the justified concern of double recovery. The Texas Supreme Court in Golden Eagle Archery recognized that courts must guard against double recoveries resulting from the little evidence that is left after the jury compensates plaintiff for other non-pecuniary damages like pain and suffering and mental anguish. The fact that the same evidence was too weak for the jury to award a past physical impairment award clearly supports the fact that this case involves double recovery. There is evidence of mental anguish and pain, and as I said, plaintiff was compensated for that. But that same evidence without more cannot substantiate a $60,000 award for future physical impairment where there's no evidence linking his inability to fish, do yard work, work on his car, or sleep to the pain in the future.
Well, why does the lack of his ability to fish, the lack of his ability to work on his car, if he had the car, the things that he testified to, why is that not enough to support loss of enjoyment of life, which is a factor for physical impairment?
Not every loss of enjoyment of life is covered by physical impairment. Physical impairment requires that there be a physical cause to that person's inability to do these things. He testified that he doesn't go fishing anymore because he's scared someone else is going to crash into him. That may be an effect of the accident, but it's not a physical effect of the accident. And working on the car, that testimony is so vague. There's no link to pain at all. It's just she is not aware that whether or not he's worked on his car since. With all the other evidence that, or all the other testimony about the things he doesn't do, it's very similar. There's just no link between a physical cause and that.
So had
pain.
He testified, I no longer go fishing because the pain keeps me from fishing, that would have been different. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. Yes.
Because he's saying he doesn't go fishing because he's afraid to go fishing because he might be in another car accident.
Yes,
that's
that is correct.
That's what you're saying. The testimony supports. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes. The jury's award for future physical impairment required sufficient evidence of a substantial and extremely disabling loss. And once all of the evidence in the record is weighed, it does not rise to the level of $60,000. Because there's no mathematical precision when it comes to determining non-pecuniary damages like physical impairment, a new trial must be granted because non-pecuniary damages can only be determined by the exercise of sound judgment of the fact finder. When the amount of damages are indeterminable, remittiture is not appropriate, and a new trial is the appropriate remedy. And
Counsel, courts have held that if part of damages awarded lacks sufficient evidence, the proper course of action would be remittiture.
If the court finds that there is legally sufficient, if the court finds that there is legally insufficient evidence to support the entire award, but factually sufficient evidence to support part of the award, the court may suggest a remittiture. And if there are no other questions, I'll give the remaining time back to the court.
Thank you, Ms. Gibbons. Good morning, Mr. Cole.
Good morning. How are y'all?
Good.
May it please the court. Defendant challenged only one category of damages in her appeal. This case involves future physical impairment, which is $60,000 out of about $330,000 verdict. The overarching problem with defendant's theory in this appeal is that she repeatedly misapplies the standard of review. She repeatedly says or implies that the evidence is ambiguous and therefore this court should overturn the jury's verdict on future physical impairment. But that gets it precisely backwards. Defendant would only have a point if the jury were entitled to no deference and was not allowed to make reasonable inferences based on the evidence. But in fact, the jury, especially when dealing with future damage cases like this, which are inherently indeterminate, is entitled to great deference and can make reasonable inferences based on the evidence. When defendant reviews the evidence in her reply brief, for instance, she repeatedly calls attention to the fact that the evidence is ambiguous or not straightforward or susceptible to multiple meanings. Well, we agree that that might be the case, but in that case, this court should defer to the jury.
What guidance did the jury receive on what to consider for future impairment, since there was no definition in the charge?
Yes, Your Honor. So I believe when there is no definition in the charge, the court resorts to understands it through the ordinary or plain meaning of physical impairment. And we agree with the definition the defendant has given. It has to be physical, and it primarily relates to loss of enjoyment of life. And in fact, we cited in our briefs the sorts of kinds of loss of enjoyment of life that can be acceptable to show physical impairment. And I believe we even had a fishing case, yard work case, working on your car. It just kind of...
Were these arguments made to the jury, though? Was the jury told loss of enjoyment of life is something to consider for future impairment?
I can't remember if those exact words were used, but we did present several instances of where he was physically impaired from, say, fishing, working on his car, yard work, and I'm going to get to that. But I think that the jury...
Yeah, the reason I'm asking the question is, you know, as you said, the jury can make inferences from the evidence that's submitted to them. So my question would be, if the jury understood the loss of enjoyment of life is a factor for future impairment, they could have reasonably made that inference.
Yes, Your Honor, and I do believe that the reason the courts go with the plain meaning when it's not defined in the jury, I think even if, you know, if I was a juror and I heard the term physical impairment, I think it would be, it's more difficult to do things because of your physical state. It's more difficult to do the things that you enjoy. So I do think that even just in the words, asking if he received any damages for physical impairment, that the jury would understand that we're talking about, oh, well, you impaired in doing things like fishing and that sort of thing that that you could do before the accident.
That you enjoyed doing before.
That you enjoyed doing.
So how do we take into consideration the fact that the jury awarded substantially more than we even asked for? I mean, is that an indication that perhaps the award is a bit excessive?
Your Honor, I think that the jury was looking at the fact that, you know, Dr. Almonte testified that he had a life expectancy of nearly 15 more years, and in fact, counsel called attention to that during his closing argument, and that he was going to need treatment to help with his pain every 6 months or, you know, once or twice a year. And that it would get worse and then better, and that he would have a permanent issue with this. And so I think that just looking at the overwhelming evidence that he was going to continue to have pain and the evidence that because of this physical impairment, he wasn't able to do all of this stuff, and they inferred, as they're entitled to do, that he wouldn't be able to do this stuff for the 15 years that he had left. I think that considering all of that, the jury made a reasonable decision. And, you know, there are cases that are fairly similar to this one where the jury gave even more of an award for physical impairment. But kind of talking about the example of fishing, kind of going through where in the reply they're saying that the evidence was not sufficient. You know, I think that it's really just kind of a judgment call. At the trial, Mr. Ortiz's counsel asked him, do the problems with your neck, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but do the problems with your neck prevent you from going fishing? And he said, I haven't gone fishing. And, you know, that answer is a little bit ambiguous. It would maybe be clearer if he said yes. But the jury was in the courtroom and was able to see his demeanor as he answered this question. And a lot of times when a way of saying yes is just to repeat, no, I haven't done that. And so the jury could interpret that answer as assenting to the proposition that in part because of the pain in his neck, he hasn't gone fishing.
Was there a language barrier in this trial by chance?
Yes, Your Honor, there had to be an
Interpreted with through a translator?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Ortiz does not speak English, and so there was an interpreter for this testimony. And so that's kind of, and that's another thing to take into account as the jury is considering this evidence. You know, that the he says, do the problems with your neck prevent you from fishing? And then the interpreter says, oh, I haven't gone fishing. And so that seems to be assenting to that. And then, you know, there is the other testimony where he says, I haven't gone fishing because of I'm scared I'll get into an accident. But, you know, somebody can have multiple reasons for not doing things. As Your Honor referred to, Dr. Almonte testified that, you know, he complains of pain with increased activity, lifting, difficulty sleeping during pain, and talked about a lot of the problems that someone with a herniated disc, especially one that was likely to be permanent, would have for the rest of their life. And, you know, there's lots of decisions like this. This wasn't in my opening brief because it was kind of inspired by what was in their reply. But it's well established that a number of inferences may be drawn from a single fact situation. That's quoting from the Texas Supreme Court in the Walters versus American States Insurance Company decision, which is 654 SW 2D 423. The court said, the simple question before the jury and us is a question of logic, whether the jury, upon the basis of the facts proved, made a reasonable inferential leap or whether the logical leap was too far. And again, as I said, the testimony about fishing that, well, do you not fish because your neck hurts? I haven't been fishing. I think it's reasonable to infer that it's going to be hard to look around while you're trying to fish, and that's one of the reasons he hasn't gone fishing. I would say that that's especially the case when you're doing a factual sufficiency role consideration for future damages. Because in conducting a factual sufficiency review, when evidence conflicts, the jury's role is to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses and to reconcile any inconsistencies. And as part of a general proposition, the jury may believe all or any part of the testimony of any witness and disregard all or any part of the testimony of any witness. You know, that's kind of black letter law, but I was quoting from Stone versus Christensen, which is 2023 Texas App Lexus 7105. And again, and we quoted law to this effect, I believe, in our opening brief, but appellate courts are particularly reluctant to disturb a jury's award of future damages. So sure, the evidence was ambiguous, but there was certainly evidence of lost enjoyment of life, whether it's fishing, sleeping, doing his yard work. I started with the fishing, but that's almost the most ambiguous one. On housework, plaintiff testified, I work on my house, and now I can't do it. He didn't say, I used to work on my house, and now I don't want to do it because I'm scared of something. He says, and now I can't do it. And Ms. Guerra testified, and they attach a lot of importance to this testimony. She says, plaintiff says he hurts, but I don't know, maybe he just thinks a lot about the wreck. Again, that's Ms. Guerra's speculation about why plaintiff doesn't do these things anymore. She actually says, plaintiff says he hurts. So the reason that Mr. Ortiz says that he's not doing yard work or housework anymore is precisely because he hurts, and he can't do it because it's painful. Again, the jury could have interpreted that evidence differently, but the jury is entitled to deference in how it interprets the evidence. With sleep problems, I think it's especially important to pay attention to the context here. And the context is that the jury has been sitting through this entire trial, listening to all of the testimony. And so in the context where Dr. Almonte says that he no longer has sleep problems, they're talking about right after his most recent therapy. And they said, well, did he say that he had pain after his therapy? And he said, no more pain and no more sleep problems after his therapy. But then almost immediately after that passage, Dr. Almonte says, but we know that this healing, is temporary. In some patients, it can last a year. Some patients, 6 months. So this is not uncommon. This is great. So then we know that we can keep doing this therapy, and this is a treatment that works for him. So the fact that this worked in the short term is amazing. And then he came back and do it this year for more therapy. So I know that this is an option to treat his ongoing pain from his permanent herniated disc. It's a better option than taking pain medications. The fact that he had zero pain afterwards, that's amazing. But then he says, now if the pain never came back, I mean, that would be a miracle. That would be even better. But in this case, the pain did come back. And this is what I have recommended. And this is what I mentioned earlier in my conversation with his attorney, is that he'll likely require physical therapy once or twice a year for the rest of his life, and which we established to be around 15 years. And in fact, in this case, while Dr. Amanti was talking about right after therapy when he said that he had no pain, in fact, I think it was right after his fifth therapy, plaintiff himself testified at the beginning. They said, okay, how are you doing today? And plaintiff said, at the time of trial, I have sharp pains in my neck. And he said, okay, and do you need to go to see another doctor? And he said, I'm going to go back. Okay, did the physical therapy help you? A lot. Okay, did the pain go away? And he said, okay, no, the therapy helped a lot, but afterwards it came back. So, you know, Mr. Ortiz is being very forthright here. He could have said, oh no, the therapy didn't help at all if he was malingering. But instead he said, no, the therapy helped a lot. But as I sit here today, I have a sharp pain in my back. The jury can put two and two together. It can listen to Mr. Ortiz's testimony that he has pain now. It can listen to Dr. Amanti's testimony that he was having trouble sleeping because of the pain, but didn't right after therapy, but will likely have it again later. And use that to award physical damages, future physical impairment.
How do we factor in the fact that zero was awarded for past impairment?
Yes, Your Honor. So I was going to talk about that. So fundamentally, I think that that's kind of a red herring in this case because, you know, maybe the jury made a mistake in awarding $0 in past damages. We didn't file a cross appeal, so we admit that that is not raised before the court, but they don't cite to any legal rule that says that the absence of past damages means that you can't award future damages. I mean, the jury could have just been thinking, well, he's going to live 15 years and have pain for the rest of his life. And, you know, a couple years of pain isn't worth that much, but wow, 15 years of not being able to fish is worth $60,000. You know, the jury, and I'm not saying that the jury made the exact right call there, and, you know, maybe we should have filed a cross appeal. But we didn't, and there's no rule. And in fact, we cited to a case, Dixon versus Modellist, in which the court says that we're not aware of any rule that just because you don't award past damages, you're not allowed to award future damages. The court says, you know, there's no rule that says that, and we're not going to hold that. And opposing counsel in their reply brief points out that that was a contract case, but I went back and looked at the decision, and they actually have a footnote to a personal injury case, which seems to indicate that the Dixon versus Modellis court was just thinking more broadly as a principle. I mean, you know, the jury has a lot of discretion. If you look at some of these appeals of zero damages awards, they'll say, oh, well, judge, they can't have awarded zero damages because he had all of this pain and he had all of these problems, sleeping, et cetera, and the courts just say, well, look, we defer to the jury. They could award zero damages, and that's okay. So I don't think that the lack of awarding past damages is really relevant to whether there is evidence for future damages, especially when you have a situation like this where there is a permanent injury, and he'll likely off and on have sleep problems, won't be able to fish, won't be able to do yard work, et cetera, going forward. You know, on the car issue, in the argument that he doesn't have a car now, so how would he be able to work on the car this is the first time that argument has been raised. I don't know. I honestly don't know. Maybe he has two cars. But there is testimony that he used to work on his car, and now he doesn't. And really, in the briefs, they admitted that that was some evidence, but they just suggested that it was not enough evidence to support $60,000. Well, I think that there's a lot of evidence to support $60,000. I think that we have enough evidence to support the jury's verdicts in the category of sleeping, housework, yard work, working on his car, and that especially combined with Dr. Almonte's testimony.
Let's talk about the suggested remittiture just.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that has been raised. You have argued and cited to a case called Werner to show that the proposed remittiture of $1,000 is unreasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
You have other support for that, or is that the one case that?
Well, so that's the main. You know, I would say that with the amount of a remittiture, it's often just going to be a judgment call based on what this court sees. You know, if you there's only a limited amount of remittiturs that you can go look at, and that was one of the main cases that we found that was talking about a remittiture specifically for future physical impairment. And so that was more just to suggest that when I've been looking at remittiturs just in general, it's usually not like let's get rid of all but $1,000 of this award. It's usually like, let's take away a third, let's take away half. And so it really is just going to be a judgment call. And another point that I'd like to make on remittiter, though, is that in the reply brief, they seem to try to suggest that remittiter is not an appropriate remedy here. And I would just say if remittiter is not an appropriate remedy in this case, I honestly don't know when remittiter would be an appropriate remedy.
Because it seems that to remand for a new trial when nothing else is an issue, just this one, right. I don't know if that would necessarily be the right thing to do, but I'm sure you can address that on your rebuttal.
Right. Yeah, it would just be. And in fact, as we cited with Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 46.5, you know, if this court issued an opinion and did a new trial, we can request a remittiture in a motion for reconsideration. And then it says that if remittiture is appropriate, if this court finds that remittiture is appropriate, it must suggest an alternative remittiture. And they say that we're misinterpreting that language because remittiture has to be appropriate. But again, I really don't understand the argument that remittiture is not an appropriate remedy in this case. And in fact, the Werner case, like I said, if it stands for nothing else, even if it's not probative on the amount of the appropriate remittiture, it's still a case where they did a remittiture for future physical impairment. So I'm not aware of any rule that you can't do a remittiture on damage elements that require jury consideration, because all damage elements require jury consideration. So yes, if the court is inclined to give a remittiture, we'll likely request a specific one. But given the deference that the court ought to give to the jury, especially in a future damages case, we really think that in this case, a remittiture is unnecessary at this stage because there's more than sufficient evidence to support the jury's award of future physical impairment. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd just like to address a few things briefly. We don't disagree that the jury is given a lot of deference when considering future awards for damages, but the jury does not have unlimited discretion in what they do, and they can't just put a number in that blank. There has to be sufficient evidence to support that award, And that's why this court is permitted to conduct a factual sufficiency and evaluation and look at the record as a whole and see, is there sufficient evidence to support the jury's award? The evidence that plaintiff cites, all of the evidence that plaintiff cites, which he contends supports this future physical impairment award, was the exact same evidence that the jury considered for that past physical impairment award, and they awarded nothing. This court is bound by that $0 award for past physical impairment, and the testimony about fishing, yard work, maintenance, and sleeping was all too weak to award anything in the past, that it is too weak to support a physical impairment award in the future. Even assuming that the sleeping or the fishing evidence alone was enough to support a future physical impairment award, it's certainly not enough for a $60,000 award for future physical impairment, especially when there was plenty of evidence of that plaintiff had trouble sleeping in the past and then it had resolved. We recognize that Dr. Almonte did testify that plaintiff had a permanent injury and that he was likely to sustain pain into the future. But again, that is evidence of pain. There's no evidence that that pain was going to inhibit his ability to do the things that he loved after the accident. And Dr. Almonte testified extensively on what the treatment plaintiff would have to undergo to remain pain-free. So if plaintiff undergoes that treatment and remains pain-free, then there is no evidence to support that his sleeping will continue into that his inability to sleep will continue into the future. Plaintiff does cite to several cases where they use examples of fishing or yard work as an example of physical impairment, but that would go to the legal sufficiency of whether or not the inability to do yard work or the inability to fish is physical impairment. When you look at those cases, there's so much more in those records than what we have here. In those cases, you have people that can no longer drive, can no longer enjoy time out with their families, can no longer barbecue, can no longer clean their home. All of that in conjunction with they have the inability to do yard work or they no longer are able to go fishing. Here, we have very scant testimony about what plaintiff can no longer do, and a lot of it relates to his mental state. He is angry, afraid, forgetful. Those are all things that do not have a physical manifestation. With respect to remittiture, just briefly, plaintiffs do cite to that Dixon case where it's, or I'm sorry, I misspoke. With respect to whether or not you can, you have to award past in order to award future, they do cite that Dixon case, but in that case, they discuss the fact that when there's no evidence of past, but direct evidence of future, there is nothing stopping the jury from awarding only future. Here in this case, again, there was evidence that plaintiffs rely on to support this future physical impairment award, but apparently none of it was good enough to substantiate any past award for past physical impairment. With respect to the remittiture, the standard is that if there is factually insufficient evidence to support the verdict, then a new trial is required. And the court cannot bifurcate the trial on different damage elements, which is why a new trial is necessary. But again, if the court does find that there is legally insufficient evidence to support the future physical impairment award, but factually sufficient evidence to support part of it, then we did, in the alternative, ask for a remittiture. And if the court has no further questions, I'll give the remaining 15 seconds back.
Thank you very much. The case will be under submission. Thank you all.